We are open. Okay. We are connected. Let me introduce myself first. I'm Bob Glauber. I am presently acting co-chairman of the trustees. We are in the process, as you may know, of finding a permanent replacement for Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, who tragically died last December. And until that time, Aki Futanima and I are acting as co-chairs. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to come and join us. This paper is a very important paper, and the process of getting full stakeholder reaction to it is of immense importance to us, and this is a very effective way. Last week, Tom and I, together with several other trustees, were in Tokyo and in Hong Kong doing the same process, and next week we go to London. So we will have been able to capture a large number of stakeholders around the world. We are being webcast, and just keep that in mind, and if you can just talk audibly, that will help. What I propose is that we just, after this, go around the table, let you briefly introduce yourself. I want to make a couple of comments. We have some representatives of the monitoring board here who will make a couple of comments, and then I'll ask you, we'll go and do a tour de table, and let you talk 3 to 5 minutes about the major issues you want to raise, and then we can have an orderly discussion of the major parts of the paper. I've introduced myself. Let me ask Hans Hogeverst, who is the chair in waiting of the IASB. Is that big?
Incoming chair designate, whatever you want to call me. I welcome everybody. Indeed, I'm Hans Hogeverst. I started with the IASB 5 weeks ago, but it seems like ages, very intense period, getting to know the new organization, a lot of new people, and learning a little bit more about accounting standards. I must say my first introduction to the IASB has been very good. It's a very good, professional, young, enthusiastic organization, and I look forward to working with it for the next 5 years, at least. And obviously, your input in terms of comments on our strategy, which we have to unfold in the next couple of years, is extremely important to me. Many faces around the table I know already. The others I will get to know better in a couple of time. And I look forward to working with you very closely.
And so, let me ask the rest of us, starting with David Sidwell.
David Sidwell, trustee. This is actually the first year of my second term. I'm very eager to hear all your observations on the strategy document. I chair the due process committee, and as you know, one of the sections that we're asking for comment on is on due process, and that's an area I'm particularly interested in.
Sam Di Piazza, vice chairman of Citigroup and former CEO of PwC. Chair of the Human Capital Committee of the Trustees. I am in my last 6 months as a trustee, 6 years. It's been a wonderful experience, and we're not quite finished yet. So I'm looking forward to today.
Great. David? I'm David Madden. I work for the IFRS Foundation here in New York. I do North American Stakeholder Outreach, and I'm officially the leader.
Tom Seiden, State Chief Operating Officer of the IFRS Foundation.
So, let's go around the table. Joel, you want to start?
Can I just introduce myself and go through my observations?
No, just introduce yourself, and I want to make a couple of comments, and then we'll do it to it.
I'm Joel Asnas. I'm the Global IFRS Leader in Clients and Markets for Deloitte globally. I also am a partner in the U.S. firm of Deloitte.
Good morning. My name is Bob Uter. I'm here on behalf of the Canadian Accounting Standards Oversight Council. That council plays a similar role to the Foundation Trustees and the Advisory Council with respect to accounting standards in Canada.
Bob Harris, I'm the past chairman of the American Institute of CPAs, and thank you for inviting us today. I also sit on the board of directors of the IFAC. You couldn't help but say when I was looking at the paper that many of the same issues you're discussing here.
Good morning. I'm Tom Gatimus. I am the U.S. IFRS leader in our accounting services group.
Linda Sullivan, the controller of Manulife Financial, a large Canadian company with operations in U.S. and most of Asia.
Charity St. Pair, the group of North American Insurance Enterprises.
Nicolas Veron, I work in two policy research organizations on both sides of the Atlantic, so the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., and Bruegel in Brussels.
Great.
There, I'm Lara Gady. I'm the Chief Accountant of the Alberta Securities Commission and a member of the Chief Accountants Committee of the Canadian Securities Administration.
Good morning. I'm Reinhard Dotzl. I'm a partner with KPMG Canada and representing KPMG.
I'm Danita Osling of Ernst & Young. I'm a U.S. partner, but I lead our America's IFRS technical efforts.
Great. And now we have two representatives of the monitoring board.
What? Alan Deckers from the European Commission.
I'm Liza McAndrew Mulberry with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Okay, thank you all. Let me just frame a couple of the issues before we get into this. As I think all of you know, we come off of, I think, a decade of considerable progress. It's been a remarkable 10 years. I think 10 years ago, if you said there were going to be a global set of accounting standards, first, people would have thought you a little soft in the head, but if they thought it might happen, they would have thought perhaps U.S. GAAP might be those standards, because after all, the U.S. was 65% of the capital markets then. Today, the U.S. is 30% of the capital markets. So the world has changed, and we have moved forward with the global adoption of IFRSs. By next year, more than two-thirds of the G20 members will have fully adopted it or are committed to transition timelines. And, of course, the G20 has as publicly committed to the idea of a global set of accounting standards as fundamental to supporting global markets and free trade. We recognize as trustees that 2011 is an important year. The U.S. has a decision on just how it will incorporate IFRSs into U.S. financial reporting, and a number of other countries are watching very closely what the U.S. does, China, India, Japan, and we hope we'll take prompts from what will be a good decision by the U.S. I think if you look back over these 10 years, what has made the IASB and IFRS is successful in providing the foundation for a global accounting standard. Several qualities. First of all, the independence of the IASB as a standard-setting body and the quality of the standards it has been setting. Second, I think the recognition around the world that markets are global and that in interconnected global markets, there ought to be a single accounting language, that if a transaction is done in Barcelona or Beijing or Boston, that it really ought to be accounted for in the same way. And that is a fundamental idea behind a global standard. And then third, we have made a great deal of progress, particularly here in the U.S. in the convergence process, which has led both to converge standards among many of them, and certainly higher quality standards through that convergence process. Saying that, there are still a number of challenges we face as we look forward to the next decade. First, we do not have full global adoption, and we are poised, I think, to take important steps forward in the next couple of years, but we have to take those steps. Second, we need to continue to ensure that IFRSs are high quality, but furthermore, that they are applied consistently around the world. And that is a challenge in economies that are as different as, and regulatory structures that are as different as they are around the world. And third, I think we have challenges to continue to enhance our governance and oversight responsibilities, and indeed, those challenges are much the subject of this paper that we're going to discuss today. I think the purpose of the paper is both to consolidate the significant progress we've made in the first 10 years, but in our planning to meet those challenges that face us as trustees of the foundation, and in doing so, to better prepare IFRSs to be the global standard that is important that they become, and obviously that they be the highest possible quality. I think Lisa will say something more about this in a minute, but as you know, the monitoring board is undergoing a governance review itself, and I think she will be able to say something about the relationship of that review to our review. As you read this paper, I think it's clear that there are essentially four major areas on which we have focused, and I think they are the appropriate areas. We can discuss these, of course, in detail later, together with the detailed recommendations that exist in each area. But they are, first, our mission, second, our governance, third, the processes under which we operate, and fourth, how we are and propose to finance ourselves in the future. Under mission, the points that are in that paper, and just quickly are the ones to emphasize, is that IFRSs should serve investors and other market participants in their economic and resource allocation decisions. That is the primary focus of what we are in business to do. At least we believe that and would like your comments. And second, while convergence is of great use in the process, it cannot be the end goal. The end goal has to be adoption. Standards which are converged but not nailed down by adoption can start diverging. Having said that, we recognize the process by which IFRS have been adopted in various countries and will be adopted in the future will differ country to country, and we have to have a tolerance and a flexibility in how that happens. But the end goal should be adoption. Second, under governance, what is simply the fundamental crucial notion is that the standard setting process be independent, yet at the same time obviously be publicly accountable. We have evolved a three-tier governance structure which we believe meets these requirements, and that again can be the subject of conversation. Process is of immense importance, and I would say looking forward probably where we are spending as much as of our time as on anything, and unfortunately we have David Sidwell, who is chair of the committee, responsible for that. But we need to continue to enhance our oversight role through the due process process. That's inelegant. And then finally, financing. The financing should be constructed going forward in a way that maintains the independence of the standard-setting process, while again, providing organizational accountability. And we have enunciated in the paper a series of characteristics of the financing regime which we think meet those requirements. But again, it should be subject to our conversation. So with that, before we do tour to top, let me ask, I guess, Lisa, as representative of the monitoring board, just to make some comments.
First, we would like to thank the trustees for allowing the monitoring board to have two representatives here to observe the meetings we are participating in the actual debate, but we'll be very eagerly listening to everything that you have to say. As you know, the monitoring board is going through its own governance review, and I won't go into any details of that because most of you around the table have actually submitted comments to us about it. But our comment period has closed. Our review is focusing on the roles and responsibilities at each of the three levels of the governance structure, the monitoring board, the trustees, and the ISB itself. And again, focusing that the governance structure is one that does promote an accountable and independent ISB. Our comment period, like I said, closed. We got approximately 80 comment letters. The staff are currently rigorously analyzing those comment letters and paying attention to activities such as this. We held four regional roundtables as well to supplement the input that we received. And our plan is over the course of the next few weeks to be working closely together as a monitoring board to form some preliminary conclusions But the main thing that we would like to convey is that the monitoring board is fully and wholeheartedly committed to working together with the trustees so that when a final package of measures comes out, it will be joint and it will be complementary between the foundation trustees and the monitoring board.
Thank you. Thank you very much. With that, let us begin. And Joel, if we take 3 to 5 minutes and just present your major concerns and considerations, and then we can go in much more detail through the various pieces.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today. And first, let me just say that Deloitte certainly welcomes the opportunity to participate in these roundtables. We commend the foundation trustees for the openness, thoroughness, and the timeliness of the strategy review, and particularly the report that we're reviewing today. I want to start with a couple of general observations. First, I think everyone would agree that a robust governance structure of the ISP is critical to achieving the G20's goal of a single set of high-quality global financial reporting standards. We believe that it's critical to the success of the trustees' effort that they be coordinated with those of the IFRS Monitoring Board and support the April 2011 joint statement by the Monitoring Board and the trustees of the IFRS Foundation that reaffirmed their commitment to seeking close coordination and taking forward their respective efforts in reviewing the Foundation's governance and strategy. I'd like to emphasize that the Foundation and the Monitoring Board should coordinate their activities as much as possible to avoid any perception that there is a lack of communication between them. I also want to stress that it's vital that a governance structure achieve a proper balance between accountability, effective oversight, and legitimacy of the ISBs while achieving technical independence. We therefore continue to support the three-tiered governance structure. And now turning to the report itself, I want to start by saying that we support the overall direction of the vast majority of the proposals. I'll just offer a few observations. First, with respect to the section of the report that deals with the Foundation's mission, we suggest revising the objectives of the Foundation as outlined in the Constitution such that those objectives could actually form the basis of a mission statement for all participants of the standard-setting process. That mission statement should identify the primary audience of IFRS financial reports as the public interest to which the IFRS Foundation's efforts are primarily directed. In defining the public interest, the mission should stress that the primary component of the public interest is existing and potential investors, lenders, and other creditors as they make decisions about providing resources to the entity. Additionally, we believe it's important for the Foundation and the ISB to work closely with stakeholders that fall outside of the primary component of the public interest. For example, we believe that it's important for there to be an ongoing dialogue between the ISB and the prudential regulators to assist the prudential regulators in getting information they need outside of the general purpose financial statements without compromising transparency. Additionally, the mission should make clear that the ISB should develop standards based on clear principles, supported by sufficient application guidance without seeking to provide examples in all possible circumstances. Actually, if you read the section on mission, section A5 is a little bit unclear. I think it's the second bullet point in getting to the point of the application guidance. Furthermore, the mission should state that standards should be developed through a global process, allowing for national standard setters to be actively participating in standard setting to ensure that jurisdictional concerns are considered on a timely basis. We also urge the trustees to acknowledge in the mission statement that the monitoring board, while independent of the IFRS Foundation, is nonetheless an integral part of the governance structure of the organization and has a vital role to play in carrying out its mission. In particular, that role includes facilitating the incorporation of IFRS into the financial reporting systems of jurisdictions globally, ensuring high-quality, consistent application of IFRS globally, and highlighting where jurisdictions are asserting compliance with IFRS without incorporating it fully into their financial reporting systems. In addition, the Monitoring Board has a vital role to play in helping the IFRS Foundation develop funding mechanisms so that the Foundation is able to operate effectively, efficiently, and independently. The final observation on the mission is that we urge the IFRS Foundation and the ISB to consider, in the near term, unique accounting issues relating to private sector not-for-profit organizations. This sector is significant in most jurisdictions that have incorporated, are transitioning to, or are considering incorporating IFRS into their financial reporting frameworks. Without timely action, there's a possibility of private sector not-for-profit organizations actually advocating the creation of their own set of standards. Moving on to the section of the report on governance, we agree that a thorough and transparent due process is essential in developing a high-quality, globally accepted set of accounting standards. The ISP's due process is and should continue to be reviewed and enhanced regularly. One area where we believe an improvement to the due process handbook is necessary is the discussion around re-exposure of proposed standards. This will become increasingly important when the ISP completes its re-deliberations on the major projects. We're concerned that some believe that the posting of staff drafts for public comment
is equivalent to a formal re-exposure of a set of standards. And so there may be limited instances where posting a staff draft for public comment may be appropriate. But we believe that the criteria should be developed with input from stakeholders that would then be used to determine when that sort of approach is appropriate. And lastly, with respect to the section of the report that addresses financing, we strongly agree that a funding system must maintain the independence of the standard-setting process while providing organizational accountability. We continue to support a funding requirement based on independent measures, such as the gross domestic product or relative market capitalization. And in our view, local capital market authorities should then be left responsible for how best to raise the funding that is allocated to them. That method of funding should, of course, maintain and be seen to maintain the independence of the ISB from national and regional governments, the accounting profession, and individual preparer entities. So thanks for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Joel.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, I'm here on behalf of the Canadian Accounting Standards Oversight Council. That council oversees Canadian accounting standards. It's about 20 members from academia, preparers, auditors, regulators, and so on. And while, as you know, we've just moved to IFRS in Canada on January 1, 2011, that council and the Canadian Accounting Standards Board retains responsibility for high-quality standards in Canada. So we are very interested in the reliance, and it's very important, the reliance we place on the trustees and on the ISB for providing us with those high-quality standards. We commend the trustees for the strategy paper at this time, and we think the issues identified are the important ones that should be considered. We did respond to the original strategy paper, and we appreciate the consideration was given, and we noted that many of the comments that we made, and I'm sure others made, were adopted. I think that was a useful process. We will also be commenting on the second paper, and generally we're supportive of the principles and recommendations in that paper. I would note that there's a few of them in particular that I think are important to us that we see as significant ones and ones which we are looking to, as they say, retain those high-quality standards. And I'll just enumerate those quickly. That the one is that the purpose of the financial reporting standards is to serve investors and other market participants, providing them with information they need to make sound economic decisions. That's our principle A1. Next, the consistency of application of IFRSs is important. Commented on this. Requiring increased efforts to detect and reduce diversity in practice is indicated in A5. We also think that the preservation of the ISB's independence in fact and appearance is critical, as described in B1. We think the accountability of the representatives of the public interest is also very important, and we support the current three-tiered structure that we is described in B2. An unassailable due process, and you mentioned that, is the bedrock underlying Canada's acceptance of IFRS as issued by the ASB, so we strongly support the principle in C1. And stakeholder feedback is important, as indicated in C3. So broad principles we're supportive of. Going on to some perhaps not fundamental issues, but still opportunities of detail that we think are there for improvement in the report, and I'll mention four or five of those. First of all, dealing with divergent practices within a particular jurisdiction, in other words, how that would be dealt with. Emphasizing the connection between a thorough and transparent due process and acceptance by IFRS in individual jurisdictions is important. That is something we look to very much, that due process is important to us accepting IFRSs as they stand. Another comment or suggestion we would make is extending the Due Process Oversight Committee's review to the activities of the IFRS Interpretation Committee. On XBRL, we would want to ensure that the taxonomy of XBRL does not direct how the standards are to be applied. Another important thing for us is emphasizing the importance of high-quality translations of IFRS and achieving their consistent application globally. In Canada, the French and English versions of the standards have the same status and effect. In other words, the French version will have the same status and effect in court as the English version. So the translation is important. And finally, we would suggest extending the post-implementation reviews to include a review by the Due Process Oversight Committee to ascertain whether a new standard or amendment achieved its intended effect with due regard to costs and benefits. And those would be our observations on some supplementary comments. I'd be happy to elaborate on these and look forward to hearing the views of others. Thank you.
Well, we'll have that opportunity. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. On behalf of the AICPA and its nearly 370,000 CPA members in 128 countries in business, industry, public practice, government, and education, we thank you again for the opportunity to be here today and participate. We strongly support the eventual use of a single set of high-quality, comprehensive global accounting standards by public companies in the preparation of transparent and comparable financial reports throughout the world, and thus continue our well-known support for the objectives of the IFRS Foundation and the International Accounting Standards Board. With that in mind, we'd like to offer the following comments. We support the trustees' recommendations concerning the IFRS Foundation's mission, governance, process, and procedures used by the Foundation and the IASB and the organization's financing. We believe that the recommended changes are appropriate as the IASB evolves as the global accounting standard setter. We do believe, however, that the report does not adequately recognize the role of professional accountancy bodies in the standard setting process. For example, the report recommends the IASB establish formal cooperation agreements with security regulators, audit regulators, national standard setters to receive feedback on how IFRS are being implemented and to encourage actions aimed at addressing divergence. The report also encourages the maintenance of a network of national and other accounting standard setting bodies to, among other things, identify emerging issues. While we support those recommendations, we note that the bodies of accounting and auditing practitioners would often be the first to identify such issues. Furthermore, we note that the professional bodies typically have a leading role in the education and dissemination of information about accounting standards. Accordingly, we believe there should be a mechanism for the involvement of the professional bodies around the world in the standard setting process. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We welcome the opportunity to participate in this board strategy review being carried out by the trustees. We also welcome enhanced coordination of the trustees and monitoring board reviews. Look forward to a coordinated package of final proposals in the third quarter of this year. These two reviews provide a timely opportunity to establish a sound and stable platform of public legitimacy for the IASB and the Foundation, such that stakeholders have confidence in the standard-setting process and therefore the standards themselves. Once the current reviews are completed, the trustees and the monitoring board should operate under the enhanced arrangements for a period of time, perhaps 5 years, without the need for continual reexamination of governance in the interim period. We have some observations in terms of the four items that were presented in the paper. First, in terms of the mission and defining the public interest, we support the revised formulation of the mission statement with the primary objective that financial reporting is to report to investors and others in the capital market so they can make economic decisions. As such, we believe that perhaps the monitoring board statement, I'm sorry, the trustee statement should have included language that the financial reporting standards should be developed to faithfully portray the economics of transactions presenting an entity's financial position and performance. We believe that it is in the public interest to have well-functioning, orderly capital markets. A comprehensive set of financial accounting standards underpins those markets and makes a direct contribution to financial stability. We encourage the Foundation and the IASB to build upon its current work with the regulatory community. Due process should include an active two-way dialogue with prudential regulators when financial stability implications exist. Standard setters and regulators may each need to take actions to pursue their respective interests. We also believe that the ultimate goal should be for management to be able to ensure that its financial statements are in full compliance with IFRS, and that the auditor should be able to have an opinion supporting those. With respect to due process, we do believe that additional confidence in the due process document will result in fewer carve-outs, and as a result, we expect to see increased consistent application. We also believe that an international forum of regulators, the IASB, investors, and the Interpretations Committee could help in leading to more consistent application of standards And that perhaps is a better objective than having standards that are consistently enforceable. I believe that the governance structure of three tiers are appropriate. We do think that increased clarity of roles would be helpful. We do encourage the trustees to have more visibility. With respect to an effects analysis, we are supportive of that. We believe it's necessary. It's an important part of the due process mechanism. However, we do have concerns that it should not be overly bureaucratic and slow the standard setting process. And finally, we believe that IFRIC and the Interpretations Committee should be used as a means to help reduce unacceptable diversity in practice, not necessarily just to ensure consistency of interpretations.
Thank you very much. Linda?
I'm with Manulife Financial. I think the timing of this meeting is actually perfect. We have just finished implementing phase one of IFRS, so we have quite a bit of experience with that. And we're heavily involved in all of the key standards for phase two. I would say that I probably spend about 20% of my time on this, which is quite a bit, and have met with the trustees and before. Some of the observations I will give is multiple preparers' standpoint of having to implement this. And start with, this is the first time I think we've truly worked in an international environment, and it is different. It is different because people mean different things when they say the same thing. And so trying to get to what the real crux of the issue is very difficult. I think we've come a long way, and I think we've been pushed to come a long way in the industry to do that, or encouraged maybe is another way of putting it. But I think we have come a long way. So I think those learnings are good, and I think what it's telling us is slow down and take time to make sure that we've got all the right issues and are addressing the right issues, because it does get very confusing. I would say that the working in a global environment means it does take a lot longer because you have to reach out. You need more staff. You need more outreach. You need more input. And I think that these CA firms are very good at getting that because they're having to watch us all implement this, and their international offices are, I'm sure, very busy trying to figure out all the different issues. So I'd say slow down. I would also say we need a good definition of high quality. I've heard on high quality, there's, again, different interpretations. But if you can look at the whole financial picture of a company and assess that using that information, that's a good thing. But I think we get confused on that. So the more we can put into the definition of high quality and assess things against that high quality, the evolution will happen so that we get a good standard in the end. With respect to process, again, I think working in that international environment, field testing, et cetera, needs a lot more due diligence and due process around it because, again, it's very complex and we all have different products and different nuances. So I think we actually need people to spend time on what is appropriate due process for each standard because it's done very quickly. So I would say we want one standard. We want one international standard. Canada's already there, and our global operations have had to move with us. So our U.S. operations are on IFRS, our Asia operations. So we want it to work. I look forward to the day when I only have one account basis.
That's a good way. Jerry?
Thank you very much, Bob. I represent a group of insurers from North America, which includes the United States, Canada, and Bermuda. Since our formation, we supported the establishment of a single high-quality global standard. That has been at the center of our activities since we were formed in 2003. I want to say that the context of my remarks is that the direction of this paper is going in the right direction. I'd like my comments to be taken in that context. I have 3 points I'd like to make relative to item A1. The first has to do, to a certain extent, with the point that Linda just made regarding the definition of high quality. The first is that I believe that disclosure should be included in the context of a high quality standard. It is, in our view, not possible to look at a standard standalone without also the related disclosure around it. indeed achieving convergence, I believe, the utilization of disclosure in that context will help the process of coming to a single high-quality standard. That's number one. Number two, I believe that the high-quality standard should include some concept of convergence itself. I will say in advance that, as a couple of others here in this meeting, I serve on the advisory council to FASB and made exactly this comment to them, that in their context it shouldn't just be achieving a higher quality standard, but that indeed they should provide a value to a converged standard, even if it is only comparably high quality. As a consequence, the board members there should take that into account in achieving convergence. I would suggest that the same should be true of the IASB, that achieving a converged standard, not just with respect to the United States, but with respect to Japan or with respect to Canada or other major jurisdictions which already have fairly highly formed accounting standards, that the idea of achieving a convergence standard, which can be broadly supported, is very important, and that should actually be stated in the definition of a high-quality standard. The last point I would make is one that is consistent with what Joel said, and that is that when I read the definition of who this is targeted at, I agree that it should be equity investors as well as debt investors and the others, but I do think that there should be a higher priority placed on the regulatory side. I believe, in fact, you're already doing it. I think it's more a matter of the words, but indeed, because capital requirements and banking and insurance particularly are so heavily driven off of the reported financial statements, that cannot be ignored, and that the impact needs to be considered. It can't just be, well, that's the province of the regulator and they can do whatever they want. That, and what we've learned after the financial crisis is a globally interlinked world, the way the IASB standards operate has got to be taken, among other things, an additional element to emphasize a little more in the context of regulation. On A2, I'd like to emphasize a point that was made by Robert, but in a different context, and that has to do with translations as part of interpretation. I believe that this will become increasingly difficult over time as additional nations, such as we heard, for example, at the Asia roundtable, I wasn't there this year, but the year before, where they comment that just taken from English in a direct translation, you do not achieve the same result or standard just on a direct translation. And this is an issue which will become increasingly important, not just in places like Canada, where you've got two languages that operate together, but more broadly in places like China and other places where the question is going to be, in my mind, it's at a certain point, in achieving consistency, what is the role of translational differences and cultural differences to actual differences in application of the standard? And I know that's in everybody's mind, but I think it should receive a higher priority, because I believe in the period that this will cover, that's going to be a bigger and bigger issue as more countries come on board. The last point, and the last point I would make has to do with item C2, which is due process. I guess it actually isn't my last point, it's the next last point, is that I believe that the due process review that the committee that you had, David, will be looking at just before a standard goes public, would be a request that review be held publicly. I don't know that it's not included. I don't think the actual C2 says that it would be public or private. I would like to see a statement that would be done publicly. And I would like to echo Joel's point that the current idea that is being suggested, that simply exposing a draft of a standard on the website for people to be able to comment to online, does not constitute a re-exposure and should not be considered in that regard. The last point I'd like to make is item C3. This I would make as a member of the Advisory Council to the IASB, and that is that I believe that the Advisory Council of the IASB, and I think there's some ambiguity of the role of that council vis-a-vis the trustees, But one of the stated aspects of that activity of that council is involvement in the establishment of the priorities for the agenda. And I don't think this is different than the reality. It's just the way the words are in the document doesn't currently cover that. But some reference to the role of the council in the establishment of the agenda would be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, very much. Nicholas?
Thank you. Many thanks for having me in this conversation. I think to start with, I should say that the report on the strategy review is, in my view, very important. It's a significant milestone in the debate. It provides a lot of welcome clarification on a number of points that were not so clear in the previous communication of the trustees. And I think the most important of those points is indeed the mission and the definition by the trustees of what should drive IFRS standard setting in terms of the debate on the public interest. To me, the report for the first time at that level makes it very clear that the standard setting is driven by investors' needs and other creditors, but basically market participants, as opposed to broader understandings of the public interest. I think this is very welcome from the trustees, will be controversial in some quarters, and has to be held as the only realistic position. But it also has consequences. That means that other dimensions of the public interest, which from a broader perspective are fully legitimate, such as financial stability, such as other possible ideas you could have in terms of, expensing stock options to encourage innovation or any sort of special economic policies that you can think of, legitimately belong to the national or jurisdictional level. And so basically, this clarification creates a new balance between the global level embodied by the IFRS Foundation and the ISB and the level of individual jurisdictions. And the immediate logical consequence of that is that the ISB and the IFRS Foundation have to recognize the legitimacy of jurisdictions having effective endorsement process that don't necessarily result in the endorsement of all the standards simultaneously, because that the only way you can defend the proposition that important elements of the public interest are not taken into account by the IFRS Foundation and belong to the local level. So this is fully consistent with the US SEC advocacy of a condorsement approach, or maybe another name will be introduced in the debate. But the notion that IFRS should come in the world we have today, and at least for the foreseeable future, in dialects and with different accents, but not only different accents, also some different vocabularies as it goes with dialects. By this, I mean that not all the standards can be endorsed by all the jurisdiction at all the time. And in a way, IFRS practice was, at the beginning, very abstract before endorsement by the EU. Then when it was only the EU, it was still very abstract because the diversity of the world was not fully recognized. Now we're meeting this diversity of the world, and basically it means that endorsement cannot be universal for all standards. So this means a number of things in consequence. One of them is the importance of jurisdiction allowing optional use of the full set of standards, pure IFRS, perhaps with reconciliation requirements, but, and I think this applies also to the US, the IFRS Foundation should push for individual jurisdiction explicitly allowing issuers to report using all the standards and not just the ones that have been endorsed in a specific jurisdiction. I think this issue will become increasingly important in the future. And it also emphasizes the importance of something that is in the report, which is the need for the IFRS Foundation to play some role in monitoring practice, monitoring divergences or inconsistencies in application of IFRS and having a research capacity for that. In terms of governance, that means that the foundation must have a globally integrated governance model which is directed at the global investor community. In other terms, a state-based model where the legitimacy comes basically from individual jurisdictions with their individual political systems is unsuited to the mission as it is now more clearly expressed in the report. Why? Because individual states will have diplomatic negotiations between their views of the public interest in a broad sense, and we've already seen a bit of that, and they will not be aligned with the foundation's mission of serving the needs of information of investors and other market participants. Therefore, and this is difficult and there is no clear precedent, in terms of governance and of funding, the foundation has to define a model that creates channels of accountability not only, and I would even say not principally, to individual territorial jurisdictions, but to the global investor community. And here the report probably does not go enough, but has to be seen as just one step in this debate to provide more clarity on how these channels of accountability can be built. I think in terms of the role of the monitoring board, it means either scaling it back or bringing direct investor representation into the monitoring board. It also means probably a higher profile for trustees. I would advocate a full-time or at least half-time position for the chair of the trustees, which has not been the case so far. And it means, crucially, that the funding model has to be re-examined, because the funding model right now is being built on a territorial principle which basically, and perhaps unwittingly, puts the future of the IFRS Foundation in the hands of diplomatic negotiation among countries. I've already been a bit too long, so I'll stop there, but would love to continue the conversation.
Well, we can certainly come back to these matters when we go through the individual parts. Thank you much. Laura?
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, I'm the Chief Accountant of the Alberta Securities Commission. In Canada, the provincial securities commissions work together under the umbrella organization of Canadian Securities Administrators. And in Canada, we mandate that most of our reporting issuers use IFRS, so there are still a significant number that do use U.S. GAAP. They're also reporting issuers in the U.S., so we do look to the U.S. It would certainly be to our benefit if there was one worldwide accepted set of accounting standards, and we think that the focus on adoption is a good one. But there seems to be a very big focus on adoption, and that maybe went to some of the comments made earlier. And given the methodology by which various countries are adopting, I think there should be more focus spent on convergence and how that will work, as I think that's probably likely in a number of areas. With respect to a comment made earlier with respect to guidance interpretation, I think in Canada we're used to having more guidance, more interpretation, more examples, and we hunger for it, we want it, we want more of it, and I'm sure that doesn't come as a surprise to anyone internationally. The lack of that, I think, does cause issues. It causes our issuers to look elsewhere for that guidance and for those examples. So I think having too high a level, to only have examples when they're absolutely necessary to an understanding of the standard, I think that's too high a threshold. And that does lead to divergence in practice and in interpretation. And stakeholders will look elsewhere to those who are able to that guidance, and non-authoritative guidance will be taken as authoritative if it's not available in an authoritative sense. I think I do have other comments, but I think we'll get to them as we work through, so I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brian?
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to participate this morning and to share our preliminary views. We welcome the strategy review by the Foundation, as well as the commitment by both the Monitoring Board and the Trustees to work together and integrate their conclusions. Overall, we support the direction and key decisions proposed by the Trustees in the strategy review document, and so the comments that I make this morning should be taken in that context. In terms of the mission and goal, we agree that the ISB should retain its focus on the information needs of capital markets, with the needs of SMEs as a secondary objective. We do not at this point support expanding the IASB's remit to not-for-profits or public sector. We agree that the adoption of IFRS is either directly or through an endorsement mechanism rather than convergence with IFRS as the goal of a single, should be the goal of a single high-quality accounting standard throughout the world. But we do recognize that there is a need for flexibility given the different legal environments. We support the ISB and the Foundation working with regulators and national standard setters on the ISB brand issue to identify and understand the reasons for deviations from full IFRSs and understand and identify the reasons for national interpretations that create dialects of IFRSs, and I'll touch on that a little bit later as well in terms of some comments on the process. From a governance perspective, we support the three-tier structure, which we believe is critical to the ISB maintaining its independence. We believe that more formal consultation by the ISB on its agenda setting process is needed and welcomed. We believe that understanding stakeholders' views on agenda priorities would help the ISB focus its work in areas where stakeholders would consider the benefits of major changes or improvements to outweigh the costs of the projects. And also, enhanced consultation on agenda setting might identify those areas that early on that might prove to be contentious with stakeholders and more contentious than initially expected, and hence result in a longer consultation period. We support the proposals to enhance the due process oversight by the Foundation trustees over the ISB's activities because, as was mentioned earlier by others, we agree that due process is critical to developing high-quality standards, but also to the perception and acceptance of those standards internationally. And the due process oversight, we believe, would also enhance consistent application of IFRS. We support use of post-implementation reviews, but what we also believe is that it's really critical for the ISB to develop clear, unambiguous standards with robust explanation of the underlying principles with field testing that should minimize the need for post-implementation reviews to fix the bugs that have resulted. We also support the intention to enhance relationships with and leverage national standards, which would help the ISB spread resources, identify issues, and help as part of the agenda setting process. And turning to a consistency of application, we agree that that it is important to continue to work to address diversity in practice, that there should not be local dialects of IFRS. In this respect, the Interpretations Committee plays a very important role. We believe that there are opportunities for the Interpretations Committee to increase its effectiveness. We've noted that over the past couple of years, the Interpretations Committee has been somewhat reluctant to take on projects where the ISB has a project in place. And some of those areas have resulted in there's a significant divergence in practice, and so we believe enhanced willingness by the Interpretations Committee to address those areas would be beneficial. And in terms of funding, we agree that resolving the long-term funding needs should be a top priority of the trustees and the monitoring board. Those are our overall comments.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Bob. And like everyone else, we welcome the trustees' issuance of this report. I think the trustees have been responsive to many of the comments that we made in our earlier comment letters, and we also, like everybody else, have responded to the monitoring board's request for comment, and we've had a lot of this discussion in some of those roundtables that Liza referred to earlier, so I won't repeat all of that, but we do, like most folks, I think, support a majority of the report. We strongly believe that governance of the board and the trustees and monitoring board, all of that taken together is absolutely critical. Support the three-tiered structure. And we made some comments to the monitoring board in our letter to them in that regard. We believe strongly, as I think the paper is stating, that the primary objective of financial reporting should be for investors and other capital markets participants. I think that, as we said to the monitoring board, transparency and financial reporting will ultimately help lead to financial stability. Don't think financial stability needs to be part of the objective as of developing standards and stated in this. And I think that that's where the trustees were going with that as well. I think consistency in standards and in the application of standards is absolutely critical. Otherwise, this objective that we all have of getting to a single set of high-quality standards around the world is obviated. We're all going to have national flavors and interpretations, then we may as well hold it and go home now. But I think, before I say that, just to reiterate that we do have an unwavering support for that ultimate goal of a single set of standards. Now, I think that, as others have pointed out, there are different ways of getting there. We're talking about one in the U.S., and we're all going to be commenting to the SEC probably on that in the near future. But it may take us a while, but I think our goal is unwavering. I think the monitoring board and the trustees both have a role to play in the consistency and application, as well as obviously the ISB and the IFRIC. If standards are written clearly, if we have adequate implementation guidance, that's obviously the first step. Interpretations, when they're needed, is important, but the trustees and the monitoring board, I think, can help to enforce or help encourage local regulators not to have those different flavors of interpretations. As Bob said earlier, preserving the IASB's independence, both in appearance and in fact, is absolutely critical. So we made some comments to the monitoring board in that regard about the role of both the monitoring board and the trustees and making sure that the IASB is the only one that's really controlling their agenda, developing the standards, and that the role of the monitoring board and the trustees is one of oversight, not of standard setting. Funding is obviously critical. Support a stable funding mechanism. I don't believe that there will ever be stable funding unless we move to some sort of levy approach. And I understand and recognize the difficulties in getting there, but I think that has to be the objective. The monitoring board, again, and I think the trustees as well, can have a role to play in achieving that stable funding. Due process, just to echo quickly what others have said, is essential. It's not serving anyone to have a rush to issue standards whenever we need to have appropriate outreach and appropriate field testing when it's necessary and re-exposure when it's necessary, and echoing what several others have said about posting a staff draft is good, but that's not a substitute for re-exposure when we need it. So with that, just look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you both for very interesting comments at this stage and for holding your comments within a time limit. What it's done is given us about 50 minutes to discuss the individual recommendations, and I will try and keep us moving forward so that we can get to all of them in the time we have. Let me begin with the first, that is A1, which is the mission. And I think most of you have expressed support of the way we state it, that standards should provide a faithful presentation of financial position and performance for the use of investors and others making market-based economic resource allocation decisions. Where there are other policies perspectives, transparency should be the foundation, and can often lead to reconciliation in a single accounting standard. This is a point that Hans has made on a number of occasions. The ISB can best account for differing perspectives through stakeholder engagement and due process. For interactions of financial reporting and prudential concerns, this means enhanced dialogue with prudential supervisors. When regulators feel the necessity to display other information outside the usual financial reports, we believe, again, should be done without compromising transparency. And so the question, let me just put again before you, is do you agree with that way of formulating it? I think some of you have said we should perhaps strengthen it. I think, Joe, you suggested that this be embedded in the Constitution, actually, this formulation, or something very close to it. But let me just put on the table your views of whether or not this is the proper way of characterizing the mission, because this, after all, is where we start. We've spent a great deal of time on this set of words. Again, I would emphasize the view of the trustees, and I think it is of Francis as well, that through the proper dialogue, there can be a great reconciliation with other sets of interest and other regulatory interests. But again, when that can't be, that we don't think transparency should be compromised. So let me put that to you broadly.
Bob, could I just make an observation as our participants? respond. I wrote down some of the words you used. Work closely with stakeholders. Cannot ignore prudential regulators. And I think the way Bob described it is exactly in, is exactly consistent with both of those.
Yeah.
Work closely, cannot ignore. But the trustees came to the conclusion, and Nicholas, you said it best, that it was important to state clearly that investors came first.
Yeah.
So as you respond, don't tell us we need to work closely. We know that. Just tell us if investors shouldn't come first.
First.
You know, I'll step in and agree with that. That in our reflection, that is the appropriate approach to take. That the investors come first, and transparency is priority.
Sam has said it just right. We think investors come first, and we recognize that we have an obligation, and we'll get benefit from working closely with regulators, other kinds of regulators, prudential regulators, and that we're optimistic that much of the differences can be reconciled through. Outreach. All right, but then, no, I'm sorry, Lorena.
Two comments on that. One is, I agree that investors should come first. But I also think that sometimes we hear that regulators don't matter. I would say it differently. I would say if investors come first, the information should be usable by regulators.
Well, I think that's right.
And that's where, it's, instead of scoping it out.
I think it's very... If I may, I think it's very. I had another meeting with the Basel Committee this last week, and I think it's interesting to see, first of all, that we both start to realize that there is no inherent conflict between transparency and stability.
Right.
Quite the opposite. You need transparency to get to stability, and that the prudential regulators are. Making more and more use themselves of enhanced transparency to foster stability. Look at the stress tests, for example, that were applied here in the United States, and there's now a lot of pressure in Europe to make those more transparent as well, to instill more confidence into the system. So I think the conflict that at the height of the financial crisis seemed to be very big, I think it's actually becoming a lot less and less, and that's a very good thing.
But of course, this is a point you've made in a couple of speeches
yes.
For a period of time. Well, good. Then let me move.
Can I add another comment?
Of course you may.
And that's on the mission. A1, I think, says it perfectly, that it is the developed financial reporting standards that provide financial faithful presentation of an entity's financial position and performance. Sometimes when I hear the standard setters working through, the question is the item on the balance sheet comparable and faithfully represented for the financial statements? And I think we do need a priority because there are so many crossover type standards. And what is it we're trying to get comparable? Is it the full financial statements, which I think is the right answer, or components of the financial statements? And then what happens when they're in conflict? And that's probably the crux of a lot of complex issues that we deal with right now.
Could you say more on that? I'm not sure.
I don't want to dive deep into some of the standards, but I know that when we're looking at the insurance contract standard, the question is it better to have a comparable balance sheet item of the insurance standard so that you can compare one company's liability to another? Or is it better to have the faithful representation of the whole income statement, balance sheet, financial position of a company, because you have to be in concert with the asset side of your balance sheet.
Asset liability.
And that's where there's a lot of conflict.
I think, particularly in your case, I understand. Okay. Let me move to A2 and A3 together. And here we may have some discussion, because I think there were different views. The papers puts the emphasis on full adoption in entirety and without modification. That's what it says. That convergence alone won't lead to global standards, and convergence aids adoption, but can't be an end in itself. That we should seek to identify with the aid of the relevant public authorities where IFRS adoption procedures produces standards that diverge from full IFRS, At the same time, and this is important and was important particularly in some of our roundtables in Asia, we recognize, the paper recognizes, that the pace and process of adoption will differ in different jurisdictions. But again, do you agree that we need to seek adoption of these standards in their entirety and without modification, and where there are divergences, to highlight them and to seek that they be eliminated? That is, the view of this paper is that divergences matter and need to be highlighted, made transparent, and with the proper authorities, reduced to zero. So that's really the question. Laura?
I think that is an important goal. I think it obviously detracts from the fact that these are worldwide standards. If every country picks and chooses, you have to obviously then have an understanding of what's different in that country. And so I think that is a good goal. But again, is that a realistic goal for everyone? And given that it might not be, I think it's a good goal, but there has to be more time and context around what to do.
The paper certainly speaks of this as an aspiration, as a goal. It recognizes it is a process where it is not completed. The process is not completed. It recommends transparency to illuminate the divergences, but continues to set the aspiration of a single set of standards where these are adopted in their entirety.
I agree. As I said before, I think ultimately the goal is to get to a single set of standards that everyone use and understand, and there are going to be different ways, as I said before, getting there. And I hope we'll get there, but I think it's going to be a long time. But with specifically with respect to what the paper is saying in that regard, it wasn't entirely clear to me what the trustees had in mind in talking about having a mechanism to highlight those jurisdictional differences. Wasn't clear whether that was, in your minds, something that companies ought to be doing in their own financial statements, or whether it was more at a jurisdictional level. And that's good.
We don't think that this is an obligation that should be conferred.
And I agree with that. I wasn't sure, based upon the words in there, what you had in mind. I do think that as auditors, we have often talked, the large firms in our discussions, about the difficulty and the uncomfortable feeling that we all get when someone wants to assert compliance with IFRS except for X, Y, or Z. And I don't think that's a good idea at all. I don't like the jurisdictions that say, well, we're on IFRS except, you know, we're not taking the standard or that standard of these other pieces. And I think we've all dealt with that quite well in Europe with the endorsement process there, because everybody understands that, but there's a continuum here and a spectrum in some countries, some jurisdictions, and they're looking to IFRS as the basis. There are a lot of quite significant differences, and I feel very uncomfortable there in their referring to IFRS. I'd whole lot rather say that they're national standards, whatever that country may be.
Thank you. Other comments?
I just observed that agree with the statement clearly on adoption, that our experience was that we started working on convergence 5 years ago, in other words, monitoring the development of the ISP standards and converging where we could, so that when you get to the actual implementation date, the differences are minimized. That's one of the processes you talk about, how you get there in an effective way.
And recognize that it will be different in different places as well.
I think the aspiration has to be expressed that way. It has to be made clear that this is a long-term aspiration, that the foundation probably recognizes the diversity of situations, as you said, but the aspiration has to stay and be defended. I think one important thing is what Danita just mentioned, the integrity of the IFRS brand. I think the foundation really stands for the brand and should make sure that whoever says IFRS means IFRS and not something else. So this will be probably a growing problem over time. I would also add that even so, of course, this cannot be enforced in any coercive way, but the foundation should probably encourage jurisdictions that don't adopt all IFRS to explain why they don't adopt those that they don't adopt or endorse, and what are the public interest motivations of not endorsing a particular standard or some part of a particular standard in a way which is as explicit as possible, because this will create another incentive for convergence.
Thank you.
I was on a similar vein to that, is that by convert or allowing adoption, you actually have a mechanism there to assess why countries are not adopting, and is that part of your due process assessment? So I very much encourage adoption with the oversight of why countries are not adopting.
Yeah, all right.
I also had a comment on A3 relative to the preservation of the IFRS brand, and I agree working with national standard centers and regulators to identify where there's not complete adoption of IFRS is appropriate, but I think there has to be clarity that the intent here is to preserve the brand, not to create special interest groups who try to resolve that through their own mechanisms, that any differences, divergences is resolved through the ISB mechanism. So I think there's a two-edged sword here at play, and I think it has to be very carefully thought through in terms of the implications.
Yeah.
Well, it may be worthwhile to define what adoption means, because especially in the U.S. when we're talking about incorporation of the standards into U.S. GAAP, potentially, rather than simply moving to IFRS, adopting the standards, if you will. SEC's recent structure that they put forth, there's a discussion about incorporating the standards into U.S. GAAP. And, you know, I think that may take some pressure off the system in terms of, you know, people understanding what adoption means. You might say that incorporation of the standards into home country standards with potentially additional requirements does constitute adoption, as long as those additional standards
don't. Well, you know, the SEC paper is very interesting because I think whatever its purpose, and I suspect this is its purpose, the incorporation mechanism certainly does a great deal to deal with sovereignty issues. It does a great deal to deal with legal issues in this country. It allows the law as it is now to be respected. What it will depend on, and there is talk in the paper about it, is just what is the threshold that is used for making that incorporation decision. And indeed, Canada has dealt with this. It has very much the same kind of mechanism.
Australia,
where in both cases, the expectation is that a standard will be incorporated unless there is a very, very good reason why. So the threshold will be very important in achieving this single set of standards globally, accepted in the same manner.
Right. So perhaps laying that out in the Constitution itself might be helpful in guiding what that threshold would be.
Well, the paper tried to do that in the last sentence, and we got some feedback in Hong Kong on this point.
Sure.
But it has to do with what you're able to assert, you know, and for you as an auditor to say, is even if there is additional guidance, is it within the sub, is IFRS being complied with? And I think we tried to recognize that point and be flexible about incorporation methods, is that you know, there may be other literature out there in addition to IFRS, but the big thing is whether you could assert compliance with IFRS, even though you may have a statutory requirement too, and this is Australia, for example, has a dual statement. So if we don't have the language right there, or if you have suggestions about the language in your comments, it would be useful to focus on that point, and we revise the draft.
You know, one of the things that we have seen as other countries around the world have done something similar, you know, facing their local standards on IFRS, in a lot of cases there haven't been or hasn't been an IFRS 1 first time adoption equivalent. And so even if you get the standards to be the same or virtually the same, still would have trouble asserting dual compliance with both that national set and with IFRS. And I think we're wrestling with that in our discussions here in the U.S. with respect to the SEC space. Would you be able to assert that dual compliance? Certainly not initially, but over time, perhaps so.
I might add one thing. Obviously, the ultimate goal is to have a common set of standards. I think it's a function of jurisdictional issues that territories will have their own mechanisms to incorporate IFRS. I think national flavors will probably develop a little bit. But I think if the goal is to facilitate cross-border capital flows, I think there should be a strong regulatory view that only IFRS, as issued by the ISB, should be permitted for those capital flows. Or at a minimum, that the local standards get reconciled so those differences are not just transparently disclosed instead of financial statements, but that the IFRS is issued. That's the problem.
Thank you.
Jerry?
Yeah. I totally agree that adoption should be the objective. I would just like to go back to what I made earlier, and that is that disclosure should be included along with the standard in the definition of what is high quality. But in addition, I think this is a bit, Bob, at this point, a two-edged sword. In the preamble to the paper, it discusses the transitional nature of the period of the next 18 months to 3 years that we're in. And indeed, I believe that's very important. There are major jurisdictions in which certain accounting, and let me just be specific and refer to the Canadian issue that has been presented by them, but yet which is supported by the U.S. life insurance industry relative to the valuation of those liabilities. Indeed, it is a practice which is a very high quality practice, but yet isn't exactly what is in the exposure draft. And part of the question that I think, convergence, particularly maybe in this next period of time, needs to receive a higher level of priority, is that very possibly there can be instances where, because of business models, you're allowed to have two approaches covered by disclosure on the other side of that practice, rather than forcing people to say, if I don't adopt exactly the way this thing is, gets put down, then I have the choice whether it's either to be non-compliant or compliant. And I don't think anybody wins by that, as long as the full disclosure is also available. That's the reason why I said at the beginning, I think having disclosure is important in the process, but also that the priority in that process of convergence, of the convergence process, is important, especially in this next period. My own view is that you're pushing to have certain very long-standing practices in very developed markets pushed in a direction. In time, I believe that the market will vote with its feet, and those practices that are superior will be possibly pushed out. When you come to a revision of a standard in another 5 or 10 years, maybe instead of having business model approaches, you can come down to one. But it seems to me forcing people to run their businesses differently in the name of simply having a high quality standard that dictates one approach isn't necessarily the right way to go about it. So I believe that convergence as a priority needs to be in there. And when I said that, that's the kind of situation I had in mind, was specifically related to this this particular issue.
All right. Thank you. Let me, in the interest of trying to get to all of the questions and recommendations, move on to the next. The next, A4, deals with scope. We quite directly say that our focus for now should be on private sector entities, publicly traded, and SMEs. And the question on the table is, how do you feel about that? Where should we expand our focus, or do you feel uncomfortable with our statement that this is our focus for now?
Would we agree with that statement, as expressed?
As would we. I think the board's agenda is quite full, and having the ability to take on.
Thank God.
Yeah. While it might be nice to have not-for-profit or public sector standards, that just can't be.
I think it's been exactly the right approach from the foundation to provide a standard for SMEs, but not try to define universal application of it. And I think even in the listed company space, there will be jurisdictions that will impose IFRS only to a certain subcategory of listed firms, and I would say that's fine.
Might have a different pace of adoption.
Yeah.
Different categories. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Then let me move us on to A5, which talks about how we can best support consistent application and talks about, and this was commented upon in the opening round, that our standards should be clear, enforceable, and provide guidance for implementation. And the question of what guidance? That we should work with regulators and standard setters to identify divergences. I know, Bob, you talked about also adding in their professional auditing groups as well, that where they there are divergences, to work with local regulators to get transparency of reporting of those differences. Was just suggested perhaps also to talk about reconciliation of those differences. It's an additional mechanism. Are there other steps we should take?
Yeah. This is the one question I have. Yeah. Maybe it's the wording, but forcing it. If it recognized the regulatory environment, sovereignty issues that were raised earlier, is the objective really enforceable or is it capable of consistent application?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the distinction you would make?
I think it does pay respect to the regulatory environment in each territory in terms of not having some type of supranational regulator sitting above each of the individual territories.
Well, certainly, I think our view is enforcement is not our jurisdiction. Enforcement is that of national regulators.
But I think it's also intended, Tom, to suggest that if you can't audit it, it's not a good standard. And so enforceable may sound like a regulatory reference, and I'm sure it does, but I think the roots of that term go back to saying, if you can't audit this, you're not going to be sure how it's ultimately treated.
A good example of that is the standard that says that you would basically record something based upon management's intent. It's very hard to audit management's intent, so that would become really unenforceable.
Tom, you raised the point in your remarks about an international forum to get at some of these issues. Do you have a view on how that might be constituted?
I think it would have to include various constituencies. I think, obviously, start with members of the security regulators throughout the world. I think investors should be involved, national standard setters, professional accounting bodies, highlight where these differences existing within the territory, and also on cross-border transactions. So I think it would fill a role, perhaps, of bringing all the constituencies together rather than be an adjunct to the government structure of the foundation.
Jerry, you're next, and then Nicholas.
Thank you, Bob. When the monitoring board was first proposed, and there was a circulation of a request for comment whether the U.S. should then sign the monitoring board understanding or memorandum, MOU, or whatever that document was. Our group recommended against adoption because we did not believe there were sufficient teeth in that document. Upon review of that, I think we have concluded that, in fact, the structure of the monitoring board is just right for the purpose of the governance of the ISB and the relationship between the three, and that looking to this effort that is being discussed, IOSCO is a more appropriate global forum than just the monitoring board for that purpose. And I think we have to deal separately with IOSCO. I think all of us in the community need to talk broadly with IOSCO about the execution of this role in the incorporation of representatives of users and all the other things that are being discussed, but that this vehicle is more appropriately the province of IOSCO and their ability to develop coordination than it is to incorporate into the governance structure of the IFRS Foundation and the ISB, which we believe is appropriate the way it is. So we think enforcement is crucial, but we do not believe that the charter of either the monitoring board or the foundation should be changed in that respect, and we believe you got it right, that that is not the province of the IFRS Foundation.
But here you say, let me just make clear, we certainly do not believe that we should have a role in enforcement. I think we've drafted it carefully, and I hope you tell us we have not misled people.
We totally agree with the way it's formulated.
Bob, several of the participants commented that they wanted more interpretation. And that IFRIC should be more active. I think diversity of practice, not just consistency. The diversion practice within various countries, several comments. I mean, the trustees have, this is not a trustee-driven answer, but the board has been pretty explicit that the more interpretations you get, the more complicated standards you get, and the more exceptions you get, and the more problems you create. And so interpretations have been driven through IFRIC only when there was a confusion around the standard, not trying to solve other problems. We expected in the U.S., in Canada, we'd get this question. But the trustees really came down on saying that is not something we should drive. I just would like to hear if people think we have it wrong.
I'll just observe that it's partly the experience you come from. Again, if you come from an experience where there has been an active body providing interpretations and it's been effective in achieving consistency, which we would believe the experience we've come from has done that, you're going to another environment where there's less interpretation and you're going to have that reaction. So I'm just giving
you that. Bob, would you say the EITF created more solutions to problems? In all due respect to the effort, I mean, that is the problem. We do not want to replicate the EITF.
How much is enough in terms of interpretation and whether this is biased too little?
Well, let me take them in order. I think Linda, then Joel, Jerry.
So you might expect a preparer to say the less interpretation, the better. but I say that for good reason, and that is because we do have national offices in places like Ernst & Young that do come up and hear these things and try to come to a fair, and I know we talk to the other firms. So you're actually bringing one-off situations to try to get to get a broader picture of working within the rules. So I would be afraid if we went to interpretation, we're going to narrow ourselves that we're going to be rules-oriented. And that's not what we want.
We walk back to being a rules.
Yeah. And so I think we have to play it. We have to watch this and get an evolution, but I'd hate to start.
The way to avoid the proliferation of interpretations would be to strengthen the framework underlying financial reporting. I think making a statement within this document that affirms the importance of actually shoring up that framework would be very important. We lost sight of that, I think, with all the crises over the last number of years and consistently pushed that aside when, in fact, I think that was probably the most important thing that should have worked.
Okay. Jerry and then Nicholas.
At the top of page 12, the first bullet, I thought handled this very artfully and appropriately, and that was to refer to principles-based. And it seems to me that that's the line you have to walk, and that there's a little bit of in the eye of the beholder here, and you might expect Americans and Canadians to be more almost in the rule. But I think you've got the wording there about right. I wouldn't recommend a change.
On the interpretations discussion, I agree also, and I think that what Sam Bicad has suggested, that interpretations should not be too numerous and basically continue the sort of philosophies that the IFRIC or IFRS Interpretation Committee has had so far. However, and maybe the semantics are important here, there will be more implementation guidance from the local level, and I would see guidance as different from interpretations in that respect. Interpretations is global as when the standards are ambiguous. Guidance is something different, which is when a local, typically a local regulator, like the SEC or FASB in the new division of functions in the U.S. would say, well, we narrow down the options or we add additional disclosure requirements. So we do things that are compatible with IFRS as they exist. It doesn't create divergence from IFRS, but guidance can be different in one jurisdiction as compared to another, and I think this will happen, this has to happen, and it's fine as long as the guidance is not incompatible with the IFRS. On the previous point that was discussed, which was the role of the IFRS Foundation in monitoring practice, of course the IFRS Foundation doesn't have a role in enforcement. I think it's very important, and this is a point which is rightly made by the paper for the first time, as far as I'm aware of, that the IFRS Foundation does have a role in monitoring practice on the ground, of course, in a network with jurisdictional authorities. And this is because of the brand integrity. Basically, the IFRS Foundation cannot effectively defend the integrity of the brand if it doesn't know, if it's not aware of what's happening on the ground. And it also has a role in terms of naming and shaming. I would make two remarks on this. One is, if this is to be done adequately, it requires significant resources. So basically, there is, in my view, a strong connection between this question and the funding question, because as long as the resources are tight, I don't see how you can do this effectively. The second point is about another, in my view, important aspect of the paper, which says the IFRS Foundation should develop its own research capacity. And I think this is crucially important. We may come back to it. But my remark here will be, part of this will be to provide statistics or information to, I would suggest, a much greater extent than is the case so far, on adoption, endorsement, and implementation, both at jurisdiction level and at firm level, in terms of how many firms report under IFRS, and with the question of what do we mean by reporting under IFRS. I mean, as a researcher, I had the habit of getting this information from IAS Plus, but now that Bull Packer has moved to the board, maybe this is something that the IFRS Foundation should take over.
Okay. David, and I'm going to then take these comments and then move us on, because we have a limited amount of time and I would like to have an opportunity.
Can I just ask a question on the first of those topics? Because listening to it, it seemed to me I couldn't get very clear about the distinction between guidance issued in a jurisdiction and allowing for inconsistencies to build. Is that where you'd see the role of, whether it's national standards setters getting together, whether it's securities regulators around the world getting together, that might identify when those local guidance, that local guidance goes outside what is acceptable? I'm just trying to understand, when is that acceptable and when does it cross a line of being not the basis of the principle, but just, as you had said in your prepared remarks earlier, just the political expediency in that jurisdiction, and how would we ever get at that?
No, I'm not referring here to cases where a jurisdiction would not have endorsed a specific standard. So suppose that all the standards are endorsed, or what we're talking about here in terms of endorsement, but take, you know, there are options in standards, right? Say you have a standard that allows method A and method B. Divergence that would be harmful, in my understanding, would be if actually the local authorities say you have to adopt method C, which is neither A nor B. And the monitoring role of the IFRS Foundation would be to name and shame, for example, this sort of behavior. Now, if jurisdiction A say, go for method A and you cannot do method B, and jurisdiction B says, go for method B and you cannot do method A, this means you have divergence of practice between those two jurisdictions, but in my view, that should be fine with the IFRS Foundation.
Okay.
I think we should also take Reinhardt's former comment.
No, we are. We're going to take those two and then we can move on. Reinhardt and
I'll try to be brief, and some of my comments may be more my personal comments, and I'm not sure if my European colleagues would necessarily agree with all of them. But I do agree with what Bob said on this issue of interpretation. It depends where you come from. And I also agree that there is a balance to be had. I would agree that from the perspective of the U.S., the EITF has gone too far. On the other hand, when we look at the output of the IFRS Interpretations Committee over the last couple of years, having one final interpretation, I would argue is not sufficient. And what I see as being the danger is that where you have significant issues, significant divergent issues, even if those are part of a longer-term project by the ISB, if those are not addressed, you will see
variations of IFRS or people not adopting IFRS. We've experienced that in Canada. We've seen many major companies go to U.S. GAAP, hence damaging the IFRS brand because of the fact there's no clarity or views that they can't achieve their financial reporting objectives under IFRS. So I think that's a huge risk, and it also, as I say, at the end of the day, does not promote the objective of one high-quality standard.
I just, in your earlier, said about the fact that we should not only talk formally to the securities regulators about divergent practices, but also practitioners, since they are probably the first ones to know. I think that was a very valuable comment that we might want to take on board.
I'll be brief as well. I think that I've never particularly liked this whole discussion of principles versus rules, because I think it points on a spectrum, and to say that IFRS doesn't have rules is wrong, to say that U.S. GAAP doesn't have principles is wrong. I think certainly IFRS is underpinned by principles, as is U.S. GAAP. We just have a lot more application guidance in U.S. GAAP. I think that within IFRS, there needs to be enough implementation and application guidance to achieve consistent application across the world. Otherwise, we've defeated the purpose. If we say that we could read a standard and you can do A, B, or C is acceptable under the standard, well, I would submit that most of the time, maybe not all the time, most of the time, that's not particularly desirable, because that's not going to lead to consistent application around the world. Universally true. I think that what the IFRIC has done in not taking on a lot onto its agenda, I know that that is what we have tried in the past, to have IFRIC only deal with those issues that they really need to deal with, and that's okay. But instead, you get all of these agenda decisions, which might as well be interpretations, except for those of us that are used to dealing with this every day. You know, you have to read the green book to see the cross-referencing there, because you might not remember some of this, and it's quite difficult to deal with. I think that we do need to guard against a proliferation of interpretations. I completely agree with Joel that a few years ago, back 4 or 5 years ago, a lot of us in this room were talking about the need for an enhanced conceptual framework, and the importance of that project, and the importance of achieving a converged conceptual framework. And we all know the reasons that that has been put on the back burner, but it is critically important, because without that conceptual framework to refer to when you're developing these standards, of course you're not going to get to standards that hang together and that are internally consistent. So,
thank you. I'm going to move us on to the governance and process discussions with probably 10 minutes we have left. On governance, I think you understand well. I mean, we say again that independence of standard setting within the framework of public accountability will best be supported by this three-tier structure. It's laid out. One point I would note to you is we have committed to regular public reports describing how we are discharging our responsibilities. Generally, does this structure continue to leave you comfortable? My sense from the comments when we were around the room was that it does leave you comfortable. I think the challenge, of course, is that it operate as it is written, and we will continue to work with the monitoring board to see that it does. Other comments? Yeah, Nicholas, and then...
Well, I think it was clear from my comment that I'm personally not comfortable with the structure, even so I understand where it comes from. I think that there will be a clearer and clearer need to involve the investor community more directly in the monitoring board level, however it evolves over time. And I'm also extremely uncomfortable with the fact that the monitoring board itself, as a self-standing body, is not within the framework of the Constitution. So it's an external body which is not governed by the Constitution. I think this is very unstable if you look at it on a long-term perspective. Now, having said that, I also fully recognize how difficult it is to involve investors directly in the governance, and so this is not to say that there have been no efforts on the side of the foundation, but I think this framework will have to evolve, because it won't be sustainable over the medium to long term.
Okay, thank you. Linda? No, okay, fine. Then let me move us on to process to recommend C1 through C4. And I guess in the interest of time, I'd just say, is this a sensible approach to improvements in our due process? We do commit that the Due Process Committee now will be involved in the standard-setting process from start to finish and not just at the end. So it is a much deeper involvement and requires more resources, and we are committed to allocate those resources. There are other statements in there. Yeah.
Laura?
No.
Only one comment on that in the XBRL, and I forget who mentioned it earlier, mm-hmm. but Bob, was that you? I just agree with what Bob said earlier. I don't think that the XBRL ought to be part of the due process and developing standard. I think that needs to come. It's important, but it needs to come later after the standard is developed.
There was a sense of not having the tail wag the dog.
That's my view.
Last question, a related question on that. There has been this question about ensuring that there's some governance over these so-called extensions. As I have you in the room, do you have a view on that? How far do we get? Is another way of putting it. It's a question.
It's a good question, David, and I'm not sure that I have an answer for you. I think that certainly there has been some governance. Tags have been exposed and tried to comment on those. I think that should certainly continue. Whether there needs to be other governance around that, I'm not sure.
Just a point I made earlier, I think that the taxonomy should not direct how the standards are applied. I don't know how you go beyond that. That's a mistake.
There has been pressure at this point, though, to the extent there's a common practice to have that in some way. Endorsed, if that's the right word, through the process of XBRL. So I think it's something you might want to think about, help us how we navigate that.
Eric? In terms of the issue of allocation of resources, if I were to put a priority, I would put a priority on spending money on translation and interpretation as far as the other new markets will be coming in. The issue on a global basis of XBRL is is that I don't think that's what gets you to a single high quality global standard necessarily. I think that served more, and right now resources are a matter of great importance. I would focus on the expansion of this more broadly. There is really probably very few jurisdictions in which people care about XBRL.
Bob, can I ask Jerry to expand on one comment earlier? This was in your prepared comments. You suggested that before standard was issued, that the due process oversight meeting be a public meeting. Is there more to that that you would like to suggest? More the trustees are deeply engaged, but respecting the independence of the board. When the board meets, it is public. What are you trying to suggest?
This is an issue of an independent review by the trustees, right? It's the due process committee of the trustees. I'm going to be very direct. There is a view, and it's one that is substantiated by current practice, that the current due process, and maybe under the new management of the board, this will all change. So, I mean, but yet I'm commenting with specifically about what we have experienced. Is that there is a heavy leaning in the due process as it exists in the moment to whether it includes field tests and companies that spend a lot of money on the field testing but come in with perspectives that aren't exactly maybe what some of the people on the board would like to have had necessarily exposed by that, that those are given visibly different degrees of opportunity to then show the results of that field testing than those that are supportive. This is impolite, but unfortunately it's a fact. And as a consequence, there is no place right now for those people who spend that money, show a commitment to the process, but then really get short-circuited in the actual due process to actually have a chance to have that exposed.
And that should be guidance as far as the trustees to the process and the overview and the application of that process going forward. And with all due respect, I know that's a horrible expression, I hate it, but I don't know a different way to get at it. That's not necessarily happening now. And I think, again, an example of this is the issue of, we have a couple, but one particularly is this issue of the valuation of life contracts, an issue that the Canadians have been working on for some time. We just have not gotten the hearing that we should have gotten. That's a broadly stated point. So that's
to state the other point. The board is under new management.
Yes.
The new process committee is under new management.
Very welcome. All of that. And I did want to highlight that that was not, you know, things are changing. It's all good. But the idea of the public thing was to be able to allow it that to come up with. Where else will it come up? Because it doesn't come up when you discuss it with the board.
I think what we're saying is that we need to improve the confidence that we see in that, and I think that
we take that
changes.
Maybe there are other ways for improving the confidence.
The insurance one is a toughie, given the variety of practices in the world, and all believe that they are doing the right thing.
I thought you had it completely done.
It's going to be done.
Let me just, because we have just a few minutes left, bring you to financing. And again, the purpose of the financing structure is to maintain the independence of the IASB while assuring its accountability. We outline a bunch of characteristics that we think are necessary. By the way, the U.S. does not comply with these characteristics at this point, and we recognize that, although believe that once adoption is effected through incorporation or whatever the mechanism is, that the U.S. quickly would meet these standards. But the question is, are these the right characteristics to achieve that purpose in financing? Nicholas?
Well, as I made the point in my introductory remarks, the model which is suggested by the foundation, not the one which is implemented, by the way, because the reliance on voluntary funding by the largest audit networks has tended to increase, not decrease, in the past few years, if I'm correct.
We fully recognize that is the case in the U.S. Doesn't comply with these,
and
so let's not.
And the annual reports have been very transparent on this, which I think is to the credit of the foundation, absolutely. But the model which is proposed by the foundation is a model where basically funding is non-voluntary and essentially a levy, or let's call it a tax, which is raised by individual jurisdictions, by the people who can raise tax, that means governments. And my point is to say this means that you're basically putting your funding in the hands of individual governments, and the good thing about this is that you no longer rely on voluntary funding by private sector participants, but the bad thing is you rely on the goodwill of governments, and that's not necessarily where you want to go in terms of the long-term governance framework. So I understand, again, where this comes from, and I'm not defending the previous model. What I'm saying just is that there might be a case, at least in the medium to long term, and in connection with other initiatives that would be taken to empower the investor community in the governance of the organization, to rely more on funding that might be voluntary but would come specifically from the investor community, and again, I know how difficult this is in practice, as a substitute, at least in part, for something that puts you in hands of international diplomatic negotiations among governments.
I would like to offer a different perspective.
But
it seems to me,
money,
and which is supportive
of the difference you can't take.
supportive of the approach that you have now, but it's, and I don't know how to operationalize this suggestion, but the G20 has clearly laid out that the establishment of a single high-quality set of accounting standards globally is in the interest of the G20 and the world in general. And it seems to me that along the line that you proposed in this document, so I'm not taking exception at all to what's in the document, but that somehow the G20 should step up to the plate with some public expression also that they have to pay for it. and that if you want it, you have to be prepared to pay for it. And I think that therefore, in establishing the principle that says this isn't voluntary, and it isn't something that you can use as a leverage on the ISB, that the G20 thinks that there should be this kind of, it would give the umbrella for the foundation in terms of then developing this approach. I don't know how you would do it. I mean, to carry that message to the G20, but
right.
Others should, but it should be carried to them.
Nicholas does raise attention. We believe, we state here, that the funding should be publicly sponsored and intermediated. And the reason for that is that it removes this notion of voluntary funding by groups that could influence or be perceived to be influencing the process. It does put us in the hands of those public bodies that would provide this funding through some mechanism. We attempt to be quite clear in this, that we believe it would be a different mechanism than different countries and utter flexibility in that sense, but it has that characteristic.
Bob, it is important the trustees view the fact that we have such broad funding, such a large number of countries, to be a strength, not a weakness.
Right.
That, in fact, if one body, whether it be the EU or the US, should they fund, or Australia or Canada decide to withdraw, we have such a broad geographic coverage that we could survive that. And we avoid the influence of the oil industry or the retail industry or the insurance industry being considered having undue effect. And in fact, with Japan, the EU, and should the U.S. join, we will have a very balanced level of funding, and we don't see it likely. In fact, if all three of those jurisdictions decide we're on the wrong track, we may, in fact, be on the wrong track, and we ought to listen. But I don't think it's the fact that one country can influence us. That's where the trustees come from this on the governmental side.
That's the spirit of it. Listen, we have now exhausted our time. I want to thank all of you for being willing to take the time and share your views with us. These were very useful. We profit from this. As you can tell, the trustees have engaged very deeply in this. We view it as of immense importance. It can only be better with the feedback that you've given us. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.